Special Sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, another chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of me and our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist, managing culinary director, and New York Times bestselling author Kenji Lopez-Alt. Our motto is, what Kenji cannot answer is probably unknowable. We're on different coasts, so first, hi, Kenji. How's the weather out there in San Francisco, buddy?
The weather is as good as it always is.
I know. That's sickening. Many of you have already emailed questions to specialsauce@seriouseats.com. We welcome them anytime you happen to be listening. Kenji, it's time for our first caller.
All right. Let's get to it.
Michael, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Boston, Mass.
Boston, Mass. Ooh. Kenji's former.
Love Boston.
He loves Boston. He's cooked in Boston. He's worked in Boston.
My birthplace, my old stomping grounds.
Yeah, it's his old stomping grounds. So you better come ready with some good Boston info. Let's start by asking you, what's your favorite ice cream place in Boston?
My favorite? Oh, boy. There's a small place in Brighton that I actually prefer.
What's it called?
I do not remember off
the top. Okay, Michael, that's it. It's the end of this call.
I was going to say you are going to be judged on this answer, but you didn't even give us anything to judge you by.
We should say that for those of you who don't know and haven't spent a lot of time in Boston, it's a very, very serious ice cream town.
They take their ice cream very
they
seriously.
They take their ice cream very seriously, even year-round, even though it is a New England city. An ice cream culture is ever blooming and prospering in Boston, mm-hmm. which is really cool.
Yeah, I think it's that sort of that Yankee spirit, like forcing yourself to eat ice cream on the coldest day of the winter.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. All right, so what's your question, Michael?
So I actually had a question resulting from the searing video that Kenji posted about steak.
Oh, we should talk about that. We should explain to everyone what that is, Kenji. So why don't you take that?
Yeah. So you're talking about the video I did with Adam Savage for Tested.com.
Right.
Yeah. So in that video, we basically were testing what the best methods to sear a steak is after you've cooked it sous vide. So we had a whole bunch of steaks that we cooked in a sous vide water bath, all of them identical, all of them cooked to 125 degrees. And then we seared them over various heat sources. So we used a regular charcoal grill. We used a charcoal chimney. We used a searzol, which is an attachment for a propane torch. And we used a aluminum forge, a 1600 degree aluminum forge to sear the steak. So back to your question.
Yeah. So my question was actually there was a very casual sort of throwaway mention of the sous vide steak sort of blooming or changing color after it's rested at room temperature and exposed to air. And so my question was, does this color actually affect the taste of the steak? Is it some sort of oxidation of the steak itself? And is that a good thing, a bad thing?
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a very complex question because there's chemistry, but there's also psychology involved in this answer.
Wow, this is getting deep. This is getting really deep, and this is so far beyond my pay grade.
No, but Ed, I'm sure you're familiar with this phenomenon, right? You go to steakhouses, you've eaten steaks, and I'm sure that you've had leftover steak as well. And so, you know, when you first cut open a steak, it has one color, and then as it sits there on your plate, like if there's maybe a slice of steak that was left over at the end of your meal, or you bring it home and you put it in the fridge and take it out the next day, it has a very different color.
It's true. It's like a chemistry experiment.
Yeah, it could start out pink and then eventually end up very, very deep dark red. The reason this happens is because the pigment in muscle fibers is myoglobin, very similar to hemoglobin, which is the pigment that makes your blood red. But this is called myoglobin, and when myoglobin interacts with oxygen, it changes color in various ways. So myoglobin in oxygen-starved environments can turn sort of brownish or purplish even, whereas myoglobin that's been exposed to oxygen and has been in an oxygen-rich environment for a long time can turn red, a much deeper red. So you'll see this when you buy, say, ground meat from the supermarket in a package. Sometimes you'll buy a package that looks really bright red on the outside, and then you'll get it home, open it out of its container, and break that ground meat in half. And in the middle, it'll be kind of purplish. So it'll be a very distinctly different color in the middle than it is on the outside. And some people think, oh, they're artificially coloring the meat, or they're gassing it to make it look red. But really, it's all this, you know, it's all this disgusting old unfresh meat. That's not the case. It's a natural reaction of the meat with the oxygen that it's exposed to on the exterior. So when you cook a steak, the same sort of thing. When you cut open a cooked steak, the same sort of thing happens. At first, you're going to have some of that myoglobin that hasn't been exposed to a lot of oxygen, and then as it gets exposed to the atmosphere, it reacts and it turns darker red. This effect is something that is compounded by cooking sous vide, because when you cook sous vide, you're cooking in a sealed bag that is completely oxygen free, or at least relatively oxygen free compared to cooking like out in the open air on a grill or in a pan. And so with sous vide steaks, when you cut them open, they tend to have a much paler pink color than a steak cooked through a traditional method to the same temperature. And so that color change becomes much more dramatic, and you can see it happening right before your eyes. It'll go from pink to darker red in the matter of maybe 30 seconds to a minute or so. So that's sort of the explanation of why that happens. The real question, though, is does it have an effect on flavor? And that's the sort of complicated question, the psychological question, because, you know, as you all know, we eat with our eyes first, and the way something looks is going to have a very drastic effect on the way it tastes. Ed, do you remember a few years back, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, back when we were in the old Sirius Eats office space, and I forced you to eat green scrambled eggs?
Yes, yes. That was a low point. Yes, so I do remember that.
The reason we were doing that is because there was a question we had of whether better eggs really taste better. That is, you know, eggs that come from chickens that have been feeding on pasture and eating bugs and flowers and all these things that people say make their eggs taste better. And the one big issue hurdle that we ran into is that those eggs are almost always darker in color, like they're a deeper, darker orange than the eggs that you find from battery farmed hens at your regular supermarket eggs. And so it was really difficult to sort of divorce that color and the connotations of that color from the actual flavor of the egg.
So that's the psychological question you're talking
exactly.
about.
So we dyed all the eggs green so that the color had no effect on the flavor. And once we did that, we found that almost all eggs tasted identical. Similarly, you can take scrambled eggs, add a few drops of orange food coloring to them, and feed them to your friends, and they'll swear that they're the best tasting scrambled eggs they've ever had because they have
awesome.
That deeper orange color. I'm not suggesting you do this, or if you do it, at least reveal to them afterwards the psychological experiment you were performing. But color does have an effect on flavor. And what's interesting is to me, though, is that, people might say, oh, well, that proves that everything tastes the same, or that these people who talk about better chickens laying better eggs are full of it. But I think what you have to remember is that our perception of taste is not just something that we perceive on our tongue and in our noses. It's something that is fabricated in our brains. You know, it relies on the interaction of those sensory inputs that we get from our tongue and our nose, but also the way that they interact with our memories, with our past experiences with food, with our knowledge of how food is raised and how it's grown. And so, you know, when somebody says a egg with a darker yolk tastes better, it really does taste better. You know, maybe if they're blindfolded, they wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but nobody eats blindfolded, right? Everybody eats with these sort of already having these sort of cultural cues and this information. So it really does taste better. So the question is, how does that apply to steak? Around the same time, Ed, I don't think you were actually at this particular taste test. You might have been. There was a taste test I did at my home maybe five years ago or so, where I had people first say to what temperature they liked their steak cooked.
Oh, yeah, I think I was there.
They would say whether they liked it rare, medium, whatever. Most people said they liked their steak rare. And then I also showed them pictures of steaks and asked them to pick the one that they thought was most attractive. And they would pick the one that was in that sort of rare to medium rare range, like very, very nice, very nice dark pink, almost red. So not like a light pink, not a rosy pink. And then I had people eat pieces of steak completely blindfolded. And what was interesting was that almost everybody who said that they liked their steak rare actually picked the medium rare steak as their favorite when they were tasting it without looking at the color. And that's only the only difference there is that in one case they could see that it was red, and in the other case they couldn't see that it was, you know, that it was lighter pink and not actually rare the way that they expect their steak.
You know, Michael, he also asked us to take off all our clothes.
That's awkward.
So I found really interesting, but also sort of impractical because again, you know, nobody actually eats their meat blindfolded. So whatever sort of biases you have going in, you are going to carry those with you when you're tasting things. So I guess the roundabout answer to this question is that no, it doesn't really make a difference in how the steak tastes. In a completely blindfolded setting, a steak that you cook sous vide and serve immediately after slicing versus one that you let oxidize for about a minute and serve, it's going to taste the same. But it can have an effect on people's perception of that taste, because people are so guided by their sense of vision and by their memories of what they think a steak is supposed to look like.
And what about those infrared cooktops that steakhouses use? Does that have any effect? Is that a trick that they're using for coloring purposes, or is it just a cooking method?
Well, that's just a cooking method. I mean, when you say infrared, I'm assuming you mean like one of those sort of sear burners that modern sort of fancy grills have.
Yep.
Technically any heat that you're going to be cooking out of like under a salamander or on top of a grill, you're cooking with infrared heat. Maybe some infrared heat, some amount of it you're cooking through convection. Infrared is sort of more just a marketing term, I think. But really what they mean is that they're cooking with more energy than you would be over a standard grill.
Got it.
And this goes back to that video I did, the video that started this conversation. The more energy you put into your steak, the faster you cook it, and the faster it's going to become dark and achieve those sort of the crust and those dark brown colors and those singed colors that we like, singed flavors that we like. Although, as that video showed, there is a limit. Once you get to 1600, the temperature of an aluminum forge, it actually cooks too fast, and you don't really develop the kind of crustiness, the thicker crust that I think some people like in their steak. The solution, I would say, is to either blindfold all your guests before you feed them, or pre-slice your steaks and let them sit for about 30 seconds in the kitchen before you bring them out. Or the best solution, I think, is to just train people to get over these built-in biases that they have, and realize that color is not always the best indication of flavor.
Well, Michael, that is as complete and concise an answer to your question as I think you're going to find anywhere.
I agree.
Thank you so much for calling.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
And do you remember that same day that we did that green food coloring test? I remember it was you and Aaron Zimmer, and I had you just tasting eggs completely blindfolded. And this, I think, was maybe one of your more embarrassing overlord moments. I mean, I guess in our taste test, there were frequently frequent embarrassing overlord moments. But I fed you a bunch of eggs, and you consistently picked the supermarket eggs as being the for sure, these are pasture-raised eggs.
Because you know why I always pick supermarket versions? Because I'm a super taster.
got it. you exist on a different plane than the rest of us.
Exactly.
Normal tasters.
So there is the question of does music, like does Frank Sinatra singing My Way in a steakhouse make the steak taste better? Is that another psychological issue?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think any restaurant owner will tell you how important, you know, the right music is to set the mood. And I mean, you too, right? You're a music guy. You must put on music with dinner. And Mario Batali is somebody who can tell you that music has an effect on the way things taste. And I think there's a famous story about him at Babbo at Babbo they play rock and roll pretty loud.
And it gets louder as the evening goes on.
Yes,
it's really fascinating.
And there's a famous story about a time when I think a guest said that the music was too loud, and he responded by turning it up louder.
Yes. It was like Led Zeppelin.
I think it was Led Zeppelin, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just like, okay, yeah, no problem. And then he just cranked it to 10.
11 to 11. but you do get a different set. You know, when you're eating pasta with bolognese sauce, it tastes different when you're eating it at Babbo than when you're eating it at... Yep. On a sidewalk in Little Italy with a guy playing an accordion. it probably tastes better in Babo.
Yes.
But they set very different moods and they set very different expectations for what the food is going
sure.
to be.
Sure, that makes sense.
For me, I always like to put on contextually appropriate music. So like if I'm eating ice cream, I'll listen to Cream. Or if I'm eating Indian food, I'll put on the Spice Girls.
That's awesome. That's that true?
That's your. If I'm chewing bubble gum, I'll put on Katy Perry.
Yeah. But I've always wondered there. I've had gotten many explanations about why music is played louder than I think it should be in restaurants. Some is so that people have privacy for their own conversations, but that doesn't really make sense to me because it just forces people to yell. So I've never really quite understood this. We could do a whole show devoted to sound and music in restaurants because everybody has strong opinions about this and theories that may or may not be accurate. Our next caller is Alex. You're on Call Special Sauce. Where you live, Alex?
Hey, Ed, I'm in Park Slope.
Park Slope. Park Slope. Slope, like stroller capital of the world.
Yes, yes.
Do you have strollers in your house?
Soon, yeah. That's actually my wife and I just bought there, and that's part of the plan.
All right. So
you're moving to Park Slope from Park Slope? Is that?
That's right, yeah. We're going from 3rd Street to 15th Street.
Park Slope is this beautiful neighborhood in Brooklyn in the shadow of Prospect Park. It's become a very fashionable neighborhood. It has lots of beautiful old houses, lots of restaurants
especially
now.
Especially for young couples with babies.
Yes, and it is, and you literally get knocked down by strollers on the sidewalk.
yeah, it's not the best in that department, but it's got a pretty good food scene, I got to say.
Yeah,
oh, great food
definitely.
Scene, yeah.
So what's your question, Alex?
So, yeah, my question actually has to do sort of inspired by this move we're making, sort of a opportunity for rebirth in the kitchen. I'm totally dumping out our pantry and our fridge, and I was curious, Kenji, how you would approach like a total pantry kitchen reboot.
Ah, okay. So this is actually something I'm very familiar with because my wife and I moved from New York to California 2 years ago. And for the first 6 months that we were in California, all of our stuff was in storage. It was in transit in boxes somewhere. And it took us a while to get it all back. So for a long time, we had to live out of what we brought in our car. And most of my kitchen stuff was in storage. I had only one box that I was allowed to pack with all the tools I would need in the kitchen. And so in that box, let me see, what did I have? I certainly had one cast iron pan. And I think that was my only sort of skillet. And a cast iron pan is fantastic because first of all, it's hardy. Like it's not going to break. It's not going to scratch. Nothing bad is going to happen to it in your move. But it's really, really versatile. So it's great for stir frying vegetables. It's great for searing a steak. It's great for sauteing things. You can bake in it. You can make pizza in it. You can make like a pasta casserole in it. You can bake a pie in it. It's just a really super versatile and useful pan.
Kenji makes great pizza. You make great pizza in a cast iron pan, right?
That is the number one most popular recipe on Serious Eats is cast iron skillet pizza.
Wow.
Very, very simple recipe. You basically make a no-knead dough. You drop it in the cast iron pan, let it spread out on its own, top it and bake it. And it's like a foolproof, zero skill, very delicious pizza, pan pizza. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend, probably a 10-inch. It's just the two of you right now, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so I would recommend like a 10-inch cast iron skillet as the first thing, a well-seasoned 10-inch cast iron skillet or a 10-inch carbon steel skillet if that's what you have. Either one will work well. And then to go with that, let's see, I would say a good wooden spoon. And my favorite wooden spoon is one made by Le Creuset. It's one that I've had for a number of years now. And it's sort of like a cross between a spoon and a spatula and a scraper. So it's made out of wood. It has a sort of cupped end like a spoon, but the very tip of it is completely flat, so that you can use it for, scraping around the sides of a pot. You can use it for sauteing. It's just a much more useful shape, I think, than a fully round spoon is. Let's see, that's two. How many items are we allowed here?
So, yeah, I was going to ask Alex, like, how big's the kitchen, dude?
It's a huge upgrade from my current kitchen.
Okay.
I was especially curious how you would approach the shopping list as for actual pantry items.
Like, oh, pantry items.
Yeah, because that's getting a full reboot, too.
Right, right, right. You know, my approach to pantry items, so, and maybe this is a little bit more obsessive than one needs to be, but I find it very useful. So I keep a spreadsheet of what I have in my pantry.
Okay, right away, can we just call time out? Maybe that's a little bit obsessive. You keep a spreadsheet.
Well, it's useful because then if I'm at the supermarket, or like say I'm at like a spice store or like an ethnic market, you know, like especially if I'm at like an Asian market, like an Indian market, and I'm at a place where they have ingredients that I can't just buy at the normal supermarket and will require a special trip to make out, I sometimes end up thinking to myself, oh, I need to buy this, I need to buy that, I want to buy this because I just want to have it on hand. And then what used to happen in the past was that I would end up with like 5 different containers of Szechuan peppercorns because I could never remember if I had Szechuan peppercorns at home. And so whenever I saw them, I would just buy them. And so these days I just keep a spreadsheet of the things that I have on hand so that I know I can quickly pull it up on my phone and check if I actually have it and if I need it. So you probably don't need to go that far. But, you know, for me, I treat my pantry sort of the same way that I treat my cast iron skillet. You know, like for some people, they say you have to season a cast iron skillet and you have to do all these steps before you start using it to get it seasoned properly. I'm much more in the school of thought that you just use it, and the more you use it, the better it's going to get. And so similarly with a pantry, like I don't really plan out my pantry in advance. So when we moved, I didn't come with a list and go to the store and say, all right, I'm going to need this, this, and this. What I did was I just started cooking things. And every time I cooked a new thing that required a new ingredient, I asked myself, all right, like, am I going to need this ingredient just for this dish, or is it something that's going to last a long time and I'll use it for many other dishes? And if it is, then I'll get the bigger version of it, or maybe I'll buy a couple packages of it. Then, and that I find, I think, is the most effective way to stock a pantry, at least the most stress-free way.
And
is that
also,
you just get new things as you need them.
Yeah, and also, isn't it, Kenji? I mean, it all depends on Alex. Like, are you cooking? Like, Kenji, I know, cooks a lot of vegetables
and a lot of Asian food.
So that's going to make his pantry a little bit different. Like, what are your preferences?
So I'm all over the map, which is why I love Serious Eats so much. I mean, you guys publish everything, which is really great for me. I just love to explore and try new stuff. And as a result, my current pantry is a total mishmash of, you know, everything from Asian, Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, everything. So a lot of that stuff is old because I haven't made a recipe in a long time. So I'm just trying to strategize what that first grocery store trip is going to be and what kind of stuff I want to get to set myself up.
Got it. If you were to force me to sit down and write a list, so I would start definitely with a box of kosher salt and some whole black peppercorns, salt and pepper. Like, those are the backbone of pretty much any Western dish
as far as
seasoning goes. So I'd start with salt and pepper. I would get myself some really good olive oil and then also some not quite as good olive oil. So a really good olive oil to finish dishes with. I would get a bottle of soy sauce, good soy sauce, something that, you know, not one of those really cheap supermarket brands that are flavored with yeast extracts, but like a naturally brewed soy sauce. And you know, you don't have to go to the Japanese store and get the fancy stuff. I would get soy sauce because I season a lot of things with soy sauce, and it sounds like you probably do too.
Yeah, absolutely.
A package of miso paste because that lasts forever in the fridge.
So I've never used that ingredient, but I know you're super big on it. What are some good, easy things to start integrating that with?
Like making salad dressings with miso paste, like a nice miso vinaigrette. So a little bit of miso paste, maybe some vinegar or lemon juice, and whisk together with some olive oil. You know, using miso instead of mustard in a traditional vinaigrette is really, really delicious. It's a great flavor enhancer for soups and stews. I mean, miso soup is a very classic and easy use of
right.
it. Mix it together with butter and put that on your steak, or toss vegetables or seafood, like grilled vegetables or grilled seafood, with miso butter. That's delicious. I like to mix a little bit into, like, a little bit of miso and honey, whisked together with some mayonnaise, whether store-bought or fresh homemade. That's a really great dipping sauce for, say, like, tempura or fried vegetables, something like that. I mean, there's so many things you can do with miso. It's, you know, miso is one of those ingredients that it adds not just its own flavor, but also adds that sort of umami, savory richness to anything that you add it to.
Hey, Alex, I have a question. Are you throwing it out because it's time? Because everything in your pantry is old?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to date some of the stuff in there.
That's where you need. That's where the spreadsheet comes in.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea.
I mean, a label maker. A label maker is also going to be a good friend, I think. Or just a bunch of sticky labels with a Sharpie next to your pantry. It sounds to me like if you have all these old things that you're not sure how old they are, or when they expired, that maybe now is the time. You know, now that you have this fresh start, now is the time to start upping your organization game so that. As you start building out your new pantry, you keep better track of these things. One thing that I found really useful when we moved was to stop keeping spices in the jars that they came in at the supermarket because they don't store very well. It's hard to read the labels. And what I did instead was I bought a whole bunch of matching spice jars. I got mine at IKEA. They were like $3 for a pack of four of them. And so I got, I think like 30 or 40 of them and used a label maker to make labels. And so they all sit flat in my pantry. The labels are easy to read. It's easy to tell where everything is. I have them alphabetized. And that way I don't just have all these random spices lying around in the pantry that I don't know how old they are and I don't know, and I don't know how good they're going to be.
Right. So are you, and I know you're a big proponent of whole spices. What are you buying on your spice trip?
I'd say the spices I tend to use most are, black pepper and white pepper. I go through a lot of star anise, cloves, cinnamon, coriander, a lot of the things that you end up putting in like a Thai curry paste, for example.
And do you buy whole versions of coriander and whole cloves and
whole cumin? Yeah, I do. You know, it's a mix. Sometimes, like, if I know that, for example, if I'm working on like a chili recipe and I know that I'm going to be going through like a ton of cumin, then I'll just buy the powdered cumin because I know I'm going to use it pretty fast. You know, the problem with buying powdered spices is that they lose their aroma much faster. They have a much higher surface area to mass ratio, and the more surface area you have exposed, the more volatiles are going to jump off the spices and into the air. And so the ground spices tend to lose their flavor a lot faster than whole spices do. They also aren't as easy to toast as whole spices, so you can't really develop flavor the same way you can with whole spice. But, you know, for things that you know you're going to go through a lot of, and if you don't want to bother grinding up whole spices every time, then it's perfectly fine.
And do you use ground cinnamon or cinnamon sticks?
I use cinnamon sticks generally, but I have both in my pantry. I'll typically use cinnamon sticks, but sometimes I get lazy and I'll just use the ground cinnamon too. One thing that I find has helped me make use of my whole spices more is buying a mortar and pestle. That would be in my list of essential kitchen equipment, and I think it's one of the most underrated pieces of kitchen equipment around. A mortar and pestle I find to be much faster and easier for grinding spices than an actual plug-in electric spice grinder, mainly because electric spice grinders are just a pain in the ass to clean. Am I allowed to say pain in the ass, pain in the butt?
I think so. Well, you just said it. You just covered yourself. You're good.
Okay. They are a pain in the butt to clean, whereas a mortar and pestle, if you're doing just like a teaspoon or maybe a tablespoon of whole spices, you drop them in there, you do, you use a circular motion, you grind them, you have everything ground in about 30 seconds, ready to go, and then a quick rinse and you're done. I find that actually much easier, and it makes me use whole spices a lot more than I ever did before.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think we got a mortar and pestle as part of our wedding registry, but I'll be honest, I haven't really busted it out yet.
That's a very hip wedding registry.
keep
we're
going to
start having wedding registry stuff on Serious Eats, Alex, so you're going to be set.
The guy does live in Park Slope, Ed.
I've been the chef in the relationship since the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the ways I hooked my wife, so she was totally on board with registering for a bunch of chefy stuff.
So there's no conflict in the kitchen.
None.
Kenji's lieutenant, Daniel Gritzer, his wife wrote a piece on Serious Eats. I don't know if you read it, which detailed in a hilarious and moving way the way their conflicts played out in the kitchen because Daniel is a pretty obsessive cook.
I think that comes through in his writing a little bit.
Yeah. It was actually, Ed, the piece was actually written by his wife.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
It
was
Ed,
awesome.
You cook a lot at home. I've been to your house, and you have a massive pantry.
Yes.
Probably unidentifiable things in the back of your refrigerator as well.
Yes. Many.
What would be like the first five things that you bought?
I have a strange fondness for things like dried thyme. And even though I like fresh thyme, but I maybe for the reason Kenji mentioned about chili, I use thyme a lot because I cook a lot of meat. And if you cook a lot of meat, thyme and things like rosemary and sage really go with cooking meat. And again, I guess I go more with fresh sage leaves, but I will definitely have some sage powder as well.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, a lot of people look down on dried herbs. And it's true that some dried herbs, like, say, dried parsley or dried chives or dried basil, will tend to be flavorless compared to their fresh counterparts. But other dried herbs, thyme, rosemary, to some degree sage, things like marjoram, oregano, they actually do quite well in dried form, and especially in dishes that you're going to be cooking for a long time. So if it's part of a sauce,
right,
or if it's something that maybe you sprinkle on your meat before you actually cook it, and so you don't get any of that, you know, that dry, sort of dusty, twiggy texture, they actually have quite a bit of flavor, and it comes down to it's actually a biological reason. It's because those sort of succulent, the herbs with sort of more succulent leaves, the fatter leaves, and the heartier, woodier texture, they retain their volatile compounds better because they grow in hotter, drier climates, and so they need to be able to those things need to be less volatile, so that they don't all just evaporate in under the hot sun.
That's
and the dry
great.
Air.
So you mean you're telling me that I've been doing the right thing? I just didn't know why.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So thyme, rosemary, sage, like they all work quite well dried.
Yeah.
Compared to the sort of fresher leafy herbs.
So what do you cook, Alex? Or is what you said earlier, are you all over the map?
I am all over the map, although one thing that I've been cooking a lot more after Kenji kind of changed the game for me was a lot of Mexican food with dried chilies, because before I would use the dried chili powder, just sort of generic store stuff that was in my pantry, and my chilies and my enchiladas and things like that were kind of fell a little flat. But I was scared to use them because my wife's not big on spicy food, and I thought, you know, they look awfully spicy in the jar or when you even smell like a dried chipotle or something like that. But when you actually, you know, put in the time to follow the instructions and take out the seeds and use it in the recipe, like, it's, you know, meant
to be. Kenji, did you notice that Alex said you put in the time? You put in the time?
Oh, man, yeah, now you're busted.
Yeah. You are busted, dude.
When you follow my sage advice.
Yes. And so when you put in the time, Alex, you find that it's not so spicy after all, and your wife is not so scared?
Yeah, to anyone with reservations about the dried chilies, I've been completely converted. It's not spicy. I mean, obviously, it depends on the type of chilies you buy, but
Right. Generally,
you know, if you follow his advice about buying a couple different types and
blending them together,
trying to hit a couple different notes, it's, you know, it really
that's
can transform.
Great.
I mean, the number one way to upgrade your chili is to throw out the chili powder and start with dried chilies whole instead, and use them as the base. So much more flavor. And it really, you know, and any dish that involves chili powder, you can get a vast improvement just by using actual dried chilies.
So, Alex, I hope we've answered your question, and good luck with the move.
Thank you guys so much. I'll hit up the producer and invite you guys over once we're all settled.
We're down, awesome. Man. We got to get Kenji in from San Francisco.
All right, sounds good. Thank you guys so much. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Take care.
That is all the time we have for this episode of Call Special Sauce, but we'll be doing more soon. So keep your questions coming by emailing them to specialsauce@seriouseats.com. Thanks, Kenji.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.